Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 11th of June. Coming up, the MK party to boycott Parliament's new sitting. What impact on Friday's proceedings? Is there a role in the Government of National Unity for the Patriotic Alliance, if any at all? South Africa's ranking in a new World Peace Index will make some sense of the Johannesburg load reduction crisis and why kidnappings in South Africa are on the increase. Well, the new administration clock is ticking ever louder. Parliament has reportedly notified former President Jacob Zuma's Umkhonto we Sizwe party that all travel and accommodation arrangements for day one of Parliament's business in the new administration have now been cancelled for members following an advisory that its members wouldn't attend. From Parliament, we're joined first up on the programme by Moloto Motapo. And first of all then, what led to this cancellation?
Look, let's put it this way. The parliamentary administration exists because the members of parliament exist, because we are here to support them. So we are responsible, amongst others, in terms of the logistics of the first sitting to ensure that all the 400 designated members make it to Cape Town, and for accommodation, they are ready for the first sitting. So in terms of the expenditure on the flights as well as the accommodation, once we receive an indication from the MK party that their members will not be able to make it to Cape Town, we had to take a precautionary administrative step to hold the booking of those members pending any further indication from their side if whether they will be able to attend or not. We understand that they are engaged in a court process, and they are saying that until such time that the court has pronounced on their matter, they will not be able to make it to Cape Town. So we are halting it for administrative, but also to ensure that in terms of the audit, you don't spend on the people that have indicated that they will not be able to come, because you can imagine that the AG, if you go ahead and make bookings for accommodation and the flights for about 58 or so people, and then they end up not coming, so the AG would look into that and say, but they indicated publicly that they were not coming, so why did you continue with this fruitless expenditure? Right. So once they are okay and their situation changes, we'll definitely, once they tell us, we'll definitely activated that logistics.
At this juncture, could the legal action that MK is involved with right now have any impact on the overall functioning of the assembly, and more specifically, the election of the president?
No, we do not envisage that having a bearing on the first sitting. I think Parliament, the National Assembly, will continue on Friday to sit. The Chief Justice has determined the date of the first sitting, and it's all systems go on our side. We are in continuous engagement with all the members that are designated to ensure that they make their way to Cape Town for Thursday, so that we can brief them and prepare them for the first sitting. So constitutionally and legally, there exists no impediment to continue with the Friday sitting.
I understand that the situation is very fluid at the moment, given the GNU talks are still continuing. But what happens if there is no agreement come Friday? What's the position then?
Well, the matters that are taking place, the discussions between political parties, they do not necessarily have a bearing on the process that we are busy with. Of course, as Parliament, we've got an interest, as do all South Africans, in terms of hoping and being confident, of course, that come Friday, there will have been a consensus reached amongst political parties, because it is in the interest of the South African nation that the first sitting of the National Assembly is able to fulfill its constitutional obligations. It is able to succeed. And we are hopeful that by that time, the parties would have been able to find each other in the interest of ensuring that we've got a successful first sitting, and we've got stability in the country, and we are able to do what the Constitution tells us to do.
But even if there is no agreement, there would still be a process in place to elect a president.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think the process that is supposed to take place on Friday is supposed to take place, because these are the time frames, these are the responsibilities and obligations that are provided for in the Constitution. The Chief Justice has done what the Constitution tells him to do, to ensure that within 14 days there is a sitting. And the Constitution does say what must happen on the first sitting of the National Assembly. Four things must happen: swearing in of the 400 members of Parliament, the election of the Speaker of the National Assembly, the election of the Deputy Speaker of the National Assembly, and thereafter the National Assembly will have been constituted to proceed to take a very important decision, which is the election of the President. So all this are supposed to happen on the first sitting as prescribed in the Constitution.
As far as the discussions are concerned around the government of national unity, is Parliament being kept appraised of progress?
No. Those are what I can call extra parliamentary political processes, Jeremy. They are not really under any obligation to be telling us what is it that they are doing. I think it is the situation. The process that they have embarked in is to ensure that come the first sitting of the National Assembly, there is decisiveness in terms of who should be elected for the positions that would be up for the election. And I think those processes are very important in ensuring, as I said, the success of the first sitting of the National Assembly, and ensuring that the House is able to do what the Constitution tells it to do.
And just very quickly, will there be any changes to security measures in Parliament on Friday?
We do have experience by now of conducting these sittings outside of the prisons of Parliament due to the fire situation and the construction that is taking place. We have been having these similar sittings at the City Hall, and now we are holding this sitting at the City ICC in Cape Town. And we have got experience on ensuring that working with the law enforcement agency, the South African Police Service, and our own protection officers, we have got experience in ensuring that there is adequate security to ensure the safety of the members of Parliament, of the guests, and members of the public that will be present.
Thank you very much for talking to me, Moloto Motapo from Parliament. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
So where do we stand with those talks themselves? The Patriotic Alliance Party says, and I quote, "It took lots of hard work and belief for the party to win 9 parliamentary seats and a further 10 in provincial legislatures across the country." I'm in conversation now with party co-founder Charles Saliers, co-founder, as I say, and also NEC member of the party. Charles, welcome to you. Where does your party stand right now in terms of the GNU talks? What can you tell me?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Yeah, so I think we are in the final stretch, not really as the PA, but as a country, towards some kind of basic understanding of how things are going to go on Friday. But of course, at the moment, everything is quite inchoate. We haven't really reached a full understanding of the whole thing. But as the PA, we've been clear from the outset that if this is a government of national unity and there's an indication to have broad-based support, and that whoever really wants to be part of this will be part of it, we've been clear that we're game, we're on board, and we're looking forward to the next 5 years.
Charles, you're keeping your cards very close to your chest. Let me try again. Are you actively involved in talks at the moment? And has any progress been made in terms of your participation in that process?
So, yeah, just to be clear, I'm not actually holding any cards close to my chest. because it's a matter of things have moved slowly.
Yeah.
Right? And we honestly actually don't know how this thing is going to look. And I think there's very few people, you know, even at the highest levels of all of these parties, who are absolutely sure of how this is going to look. So we know we're going to be part of it, but we are not entirely clear yet of exactly how it's going to play out. And this isn't gamesmanship or anything like that. It's the truth. And I think it's a reflection of the fact that we haven't had much time to really get the bigger moving parts in place. And the bigger moving parts here are obviously the larger parties. And as the PA, we know that by tomorrow, we'll have had a chance to make up our minds around whether we are happy with where we fit into this. But for now, there simply isn't enough information as yet for us to make that decision.
All right. Given that you're a smaller party, have any offers been put on the table to the PA?
There's been some preliminary kind of, call it more back-channel discussions, you know, corridor discussions around we're thinking something like this or like that. But as for a firm offer from, and I mean, because the GNU is the ANC's brainchild and it's their proposal, we have to hear from them formally to say, this is how we see you. Do you accept? Do you want more? You know, or can we proceed on this basis? Until we actually get that formal proposal, we're not in a position to say if we're happy with it or not. I mean, I can tell you that if it's an insulting offer, right, then we would prefer to go into the opposition. We don't want to do that. We do want to be part of this GNU, but we're not going to be part of this GNU just to be part of something. And we don't feel that our value is being recognized.
What would construe an insulting offer then?
We'll have to look at it, you know, but if you think about how, let's take, for example, the only other person that has been a minister under the ANC over the previous 5 years, and that being Patricia de Lille and Cope, right? She was given a ministry at a time when the ANC didn't really need it. And obviously, as the PA, we feel we've done a lot more and we've got a lot more to offer. So for us, there is a little bit of a precedent set. And there's also the sense that you wouldn't want to think that the two big parties are just kind of taking everything and just humoring or patronizing everybody else, right? There has to be a sense that we're actually at the table, we're being taken seriously, and that if we're being included in a real government of national unity, that basic level of respect is there. You know, so I don't want to say, it's not my decision, it's the PA's decision to decide what's a good enough offer or not. Right, but I don't think that, for example, if they came and they said, "Well, here's one deputy minister," I don't think that would be enough. For example,
but what you really want is the Department of Home Affairs.
Well, we've expressed our interest in it. Right, if there's an argument to be made about it or a debate to be had about it, to say actually we feel the PA can do better, you know, I mean, police would be even better for us, if I have to be honest, but. If there's a debate to be had to say, actually, we don't see the PA here, these are the reasons, and we can have that discussion, and it's done in a spirit of respect and openness, and we can come on board and say, all right, we understand the issues, we understand the limitations, maybe we're not wanted in the security cluster or whatever it is, that's a debate that can be had. But of course, we have to at least show what we're interested in, and Home Affairs is something that people can identify with us. It fits our brand. It fits where we feel we can add a lot of value as a political party, because we've thought about this issue a lot. So Home Affairs would work for us. It's a good fit. It wouldn't necessarily be a good fit for illegal foreigners in the country, but it would certainly be a good fit for us, and we believe the country. We feel we'd add a lot of value there, but it's not a case of Home Affairs or nothing.
All right, Charles Lewis, we'll leave it there. Patriotic Alliance co-founder, NEC member, thank you very much for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, every year, the Institute for Economics and Peace puts out a study on the most peaceful nations in the world. So where does South Africa stand, and what does this survey set out to accomplish? Steve Kalia is founder and executive chairman of the Institute. He joins me now. And first of all, maybe just explain the significance of this Global Peace Index and what specifically it sets out to measure.
The Global Peace Index measures the relative peacefulness of the countries of the world. It carries 163, which is roughly 99.7% of the world's population. The aim of the index is to be able to understand the relative state of peace. Now, that's used in things like risk assessments by organisations such as Morgan Stanley Composite Index, used by many of the multilaterals to understand what countries are at risk and fragile. But more important, it gives a statistical base to understand the qualities which are associated with highly peaceful societies. One of those things is higher per capita income.
So, Steve, we have at the moment, according to the report, 92 countries engaged in conflicts beyond their borders. What is the impact then on global peace and security? At first glance, it would seem to be a very dismal picture.
Yes, I think the report this year is particularly a downbeat. So if we're looking at today, we've got 56 conflicts raging. That's more than any stage since the Second World War. We also have got more countries involved in a conflict beyond their borders, 92, than at any point since the inception of the Global Peace Index in 2008. And so what's happened since the rise of a number of other major international powers, and also many of the mid-ranking countries getting more involved in their regions, it's making it a lot more difficult to actually solve conflicts. So we went back to the 1970s, for example. 49% of all conflicts resulted in a victory, either for the government or the rebels. That was down to 9% in the 2010s. Similarly, in the same period, if you looked at peace agreements, that fell from 23% down to 4%. So what that means is we've got this rising number of the unsolved conflicts. Now, that comes with an economic cost. So, for example, if we look at Syria, the GDP of Syria dropped 87% from the onset of the war. And if we look at the Ukraine, it dropped 39% in the first year.
I'm interested to know what impact the ongoing conflict in Gaza has had on global peacefulness, if I can refer to it as that, and maybe the implications for the involved regions right now, as this shows no sign of abating.
Yes, well, obviously there's a peace deal on the table from the UN, but we'll have to see how that goes. So Israel is now in one of the least peaceful countries in the world. It's in the bottom 10. It dropped 11 places to 155, fell on all domains. The big ones were political instability, terrorism, perceptions of crime, violent demonstrations, and obviously a whole range of indicators around conflict. Now, if we're looking in, so that made it one of the five biggest fallers in the index. Palestine, obviously, was also in the same domain. The thing which I'd like to really bring to everyone's attention, if we look at the countries surrounding Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Iran, what we find is the total of those economies is about $3 trillion. So if we looked at a fall of 40% in the GDP, if the conflict expanded, that'd come to about $1.2 trillion. And that would be a severe impact on the global economy. And the flow-on effects would be much more than that, because it then the ripple effects infect a whole range of other countries. Also need to think about the increased refugees, and also the likelihood of an expanded level of terrorism.
Just a quick one in conclusion then, where does South Africa currently stand in the GPI?
Well, South Africa currently stands at 127. It had a slight fall this year, down two places. But it was mainly on the back of increased political instability, higher perceptions of criminality and also a drop in commitments to UN peacekeeping operations.
I am going to leave it there. Steve Khalil, thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
Okay.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, despite around 75 days, if I'm not mistaken, without load shedding, starting yesterday, some Johannesburg residents contending with load reduction. So what is all of this about and what sort of impact is it having? I'm joined by the City of Johannesburg Mayor Kabelo Gwamanda. Mayor Gwamanda, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. I want to start with money collection, if I can. The city says it's still owed billions by Eskom. I know this matter has gone to court. Is this having an impact on your ability to supply and therefore the load reduction?
Good afternoon, Jerry, and good afternoon to your listeners. So load reduction in the main is not a supply and demand issue. It's the strain on our infrastructure and the grid at the moment due to high consumptions of electricity. So on the supply end, we are fine. The debt that Eskom owes to the city of Johannesburg is continuously being negotiated, but that has got nothing to do with the challenge at the moment.
It's got to do with high consumption, but also poor maintenance over many, many years.
I would agree with you. The state of our infrastructure in the present is not. It's in dire need of maintenance. However, we have tried in the past financial year to introduce one substation, and we also introduced what we call microgrids. Now, microgrids are a measure to mitigate the issue of electricity consumption, where we insulate informal settlements from the actual base electricity that is required to be redirected to businesses and commercial hubs, so as to manage the electricity theft as well as the high demand that comes as a result of the cold winter season.
But the reality of the situation is City Power simply doesn't have enough money to implement the kind of infrastructure repair and maintenance that is needed. Therefore, load reduction is going to continue in perpetuity.
I disagree. We are struggling, yes, with the necessary budget that is required for us to fully address the challenges in the immediate. However, we have entered into an agreement with the provincial government managed through COGTA, which is to, in fact, use City Power as a special purpose vehicle to assist with other metros in and around Gauteng. Now, that is a means for us to attract and generate alternative revenue to supplement what we are already generating as City Power, so that we can ensure that we budget sufficiently for our infrastructure.
So how much money would you gather from an exercise like that, and how would it be prioritized?
So currently, we are in a 1.2 billion agreement with the provincial government in relation to the projects that we are currently undertaking. For them, as you would have seen, the high masts that we've been erecting in other municipalities, we've also implemented the microgrids as well in other municipalities. So in totality, the budget is 1.2 billion.
I'm interested to know how high density areas are being determined for the current power interruptions that that you've implemented.
So City Power uses a SCADA system that is linked to the substations, whereby we are able to pick up block by block in terms of which area has the high consumption of electricity. And that enables us to not only consider it in the load reduction, but also affords us the opportunity to be able to deploy JMPD officers to enforce the bylaws that are required in terms of illegal connections, because in many instances we have encountered that the high demand is in relation to illegality that is prevalent in the city of Johannesburg.
Are those law enforcement officials actually doing the job right now, and have you had any results as stemming from that?
Officially, we are going to launch a comprehensive campaign to a press briefing that we'll be holding tomorrow. JMPD is giving us a roadmap in terms of their deployment and the areas that they'll be covering, as well as the shifts. We will not be giving the entire plan in our press briefing, but we'll give an overall view on our approach that is multifaceted to this particular approach, because load reduction is the last resort on the part of the city. We need to ensure that we deploy other mechanisms that will relieve the pressure, and those measures would obviously have to do with the illegal connections and the cuts that we'll be doing.
All right, we will await that announcement. Kabelo Gwamanda from the City of Johannesburg, the Mayor of the Metro, thank you very much for joining me today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Disturbingly, South Africa is becoming one of the world's kidnap-for-ransom hotspots, and we are now ranked sixth globally based on the increasing prevalence of such crime. More now from Chad Thomas, who is the Chief Executive Officer of IRS Forensic Investigations. And first of all then, what factors are contributing to this rise?
In my opinion, there's two major factors that have caused us to become the number one kidnapping hotspot in Africa, and of course now this latest report puts us at number six globally. The first is consequences and accountability. When you look at rape conviction rates sitting at 5%, you look at murder rate convictions sitting at 10 to 12%, it shows that there isn't much consequence and accountability, and it makes criminals feel that they can get away with more and more crimes. We see opportunistic criminals escalating. The second factor that contributes to kidnap for ransom becoming such a massive problem in South Africa is, of course, copycat kidnapping. So when kidnap for ransom started in South Africa and gained momentum a couple of years ago, it was off the Mozambican model. It was very strong in Maputo. The syndicates operated there. They targeted businessmen from cash-rich environments that dealt specifically in cash. They may have been in the wholesale business, the distribution business, etc. And that syndicate spread its tentacles into South Africa. We saw businessmen from predominantly the Muslim community targeted in towns like Mafeking, towns like Polokwane. We then saw it spread to places like Lodi, Mlanesia, Fordsburg, and then countrywide. The copycats came in because they saw how lucrative it was, and it didn't help that we heard that millions, in some cases tens of millions of rands, were being paid in ransom money. This meant that opportunistic criminals across the social fabric started to get involved. We heard of kidnappings taking place in informal settlements, in middle-class suburbia, where children were being held in informal settlements for maybe 500 rand, 2,000 rand. People were being kidnapped in suburbia for 50,000 rand, maybe 100,000 rand. So the copycat, after the emergence of these top-tier type syndicates, has become a major problem in South Africa.
Chad, are there new steps that particularly high net worth individuals and their families can take to protect themselves from this new threat that you're talking about?
Of course, and it just shows again in society this disparity between the haves and the have-nots. And while we're seeing these copycat kidnappings taking place in informal settlements, in townships, and in middle-class suburbia, your top-tier management and leadership of companies that are being targeted can hire bulletproof vehicles, they can hire bodyguards, they can live safely within gated communities. Some have even taken to living abroad and coming back to South Africa once a month or once every 2 months. We know of many Muslim businessmen that have now moved to Dubai and actually operate their businesses from Dubai because they don't want to be at risk in South Africa, despite the fact that they may have armed cavalcades, they may have bulletproof vehicles, they may have bodyguards. Of course, this doesn't extend to your average Joe. Your average Joe is now becoming the victims. We've got express kidnappings. We've got kidnappings where people are being held just for a few hours so that the perpetrators can have access to their online banking via their mobile devices. And it's spurned a whole new industry in South Africa. And of course, it comes back to my earlier point. Without there being sufficient accountability and consequences for perpetrators, and they're seeing how violent criminals are getting away with crime, it's just made it so much more lucrative for criminals.
Do you think sufficient measures then are being taken by law enforcement agencies? And if not, what needs to change in that respect?
Wow, we're in the eye of a perfect storm in South Africa. We don't just see an increase in financial crime like we've seen the world over, but South Africa has this inherent problem of violent crime, and we rank always in the top three when it comes to things like rape, murder, etc. The police, they don't have sufficient resources. The prosecutors don't have sufficient resources. What we're seeing is crime intelligence has become somewhat more capacitated, and they, in fact, were the lead agency in the establishment of the anti-kidnapping task team within SAPS, and crime intelligence are beginning to make inroads in cases such as kidnapping, cash in transit heist, ATM bombings, etc. But they still themselves don't have sufficient resources and capacity, and it comes down to funding. When you hear that the Hawks only get 2% of the annual police budget, you start asking, well, their name is Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation. Where are the priorities? You hear that VIP protection and security services within SAPS actually get more of the police budget than what the Hawks do. So you start questioning the fact that if the Hawks are only 50% capacitated and that's due to funding, why don't we make more funding available? One looks to the UK. The UK measured financial crime as 40% of all reported crime. They have thrown resources at this by opening up those resources by declaring financial crime a national security threat. We need to do the same.
Chad Thomas, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining me today, Chief Executive Officer, IRS Forensic Investigations. And just before I leave you, on our last online poll, the economic impact of a government of national unity, I asked you if it was positive, negative or neutral. Half our respondents saying they feel confident about its success. And today, the Mkhonto weSizwe party to boycott the new parliament sitting Friday. Is this of concern, no issue at all, or a sign of things to come? If you have a view on that, please share your thoughts either on our X or LinkedIn pages. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.